Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. The first segment of our show today is kind of a little different, folks. Comes from the idea that a good story and a great tale of disability life strike anywhere. I was recently traveling on a Via Rail line and ended up sitting beside someone who had a story of disability life she decided to share. Now, the second leg of this trip, after the interview you're going to hear, I ended up meeting some other people and ended up sharing just a little bit about the work that I do and the stories I've been privileged to share. And honestly, a woman named Teresa that I met out there said she might have something she wants to call in and talk about. So if you're out there listening, I just wanted to give a shout out and say you'd be most welcome. And now, on with the first interview.
Wells here with
Phyllis Penn.
Will be telling us a little bit about her diagnosis and where it's taken her in life. So you mentioned you're a type 2 diabetic?
Yeah. I was diagnosed after the birth of my 25-year-old son. So it was 25 years ago.
So how did the diagnosis come about? Were there any warning signs? Or?
It was gestational diabetes at first. And it wasn't really, really bad or anything like that. Like, you know, my sugars weren't really that high.
So, how did the diagnosis impact you as a person?
I don't know. I don't know if it's made really much impact only on my health. You know, it's like, I don't like taking pills for one thing, but I try to follow the instructions anyways, pills and stuff.
So, have you managed to control the condition since you were diagnosed?
At first, it was good. I was able to keep my blood sugars down really, really good. But over the years, I've had to take more medication. And now I take 4 pills a day plus insulin at night.
So, do you find there's enough awareness in the medical community for people in your circumstance? Enough support available?
I don't know, because I think there is a cure out there. I mean, you hear about it all the time, like on TV and stuff like that, that there's a cure for diabetes. But the big pharma don't want nobody to know about it, so I don't know how true that is. But you can control it through a diet, too.
So what have been some of the greatest support systems, things that have helped you with your condition?
The most support I find is like from my family, because you go to a doctor and they're just dishing out pills, they're dishing out medication, and that's it. But my family has been really, really good support and, like, you know, encouraging me and giving me a bit of advice, stuff like that.
Well, can you give me an example of some of the advice they've given?
Well, first thing, one thing they say is change your heating habit. I have. And, well, basically, it tells me be careful, take care of myself, and watch, because they're usually like a diabetic, their feet get bad and stuff like that. And this is be careful of your feet and things like that, right? So,
so if you could send any message to the community about how it is manageable, how you can stay strong with the condition, what would you say?
Well, I don't know. Well, eat plenty of veggies for sure, and cut out a lot of the sweets. You know, cut out a lot of junk foods, and because I've been doing a certain soup that really kept my diabetes really down, like to 5 actually.
So, you mentioned to me earlier that you're quite the author. Has your diagnosis impacted your writing or anything you want to achieve, or do you think you can still accomplish the things you want to in life?
Actually, I was diagnosed a diabetic when I wrote my book, so it didn't really impact anything like that. I mean, it did make a difference. I mean, you know, I still got it up here, upstairs, so it doesn't impact that or anything like that. And no.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this.
And you're welcome.
In this next segment of our show, we're going to hear from Katya Hill from the AAC Institute. Erica Mossholder from the Children's Craniofacial Association. So tell me a little bit about the Craniofacial Association.
Well, CCA is a 28-year-old nonprofit, and we're headquartered in Texas, but we serve families nationwide. And our mission is empowering and giving hope to individuals and families with facial differences. And that includes differences that come about from craniofacial conditions, trauma, accidents, and other, non-congenital birth defects. And so we are what we like to call one big family, and we accept anyone with a facial difference who needs a support system, and we're really based up of a lot of committed families who kind of take care of each other. We do family networking. We have networking events. We have video support calls and a pretty robust social media platform so folks can connect and just feel like they're not alone in the journey. And that is kind of the highlight of what we do, is helping people not feel so alone, because the conditions are pretty rare. And other than maybe meeting other families with craniofacial conditions in their hospital centers and their medical centers, families don't really have that support network in their local region. So we provide that to them.
So are there any challenges in providing this?
There are definitely challenges. One is just trying to keep the families engaged. It hasn't been the biggest challenge we've faced because our families are so passionate. But, just building up a strong support network and keeping those families engaged and excited to take care of one another and providing resources for them to do that. So, like, we want to be able to host the video chat. We want to be able to host mixers and picnics and things on the ground, just providing them the resources. Sometimes that's funding, sometimes that's marketing. That's been the biggest challenge, because we find the families want to do that, but they need a little help from the larger organization backing them. And that's what we have really focused on doing the last 2 to 3 years.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time with this work, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Absolutely. I think one of our biggest goals throughout these, near 3 decades has been increasing public awareness and acceptance of differences. And the success moment that I can really point to was when the movie Wonder came out last year. We had been using the book for years prior in kind of educational outreach in schools, and we have student speakers who can go in and share their stories after a classroom reads the book. But when the movie came out, it brought our topic to the national conversation, And we worked for 2 years in advance of that movie to try to craft the message that we wanted the public to take home. We didn't want it to be sad. We didn't want it to be one of pity. And we worked with the producers. We worked with some of the actors to help them understand that they're telling our story, and we want it to be authentic, but also hopeful and also helpful to the general public. So when they do meet someone with a facial difference, you know, in an ice cream shop or a restaurant or at school, they know how to act. You know, first of all, share a genuine smile, ask someone's name, and it's more about helping the public feel comfortable. And that has been a huge success, because no other way were we able to reach so many people and empower those people to feel confident to make friends with our kids with facial differences until that movie really helped us do that.
So I know from prior interviews that I've done on the subject that when someone with a facial difference meets someone like them for the first time, it really changes the world. Do you have any stories along those lines?
Absolutely. That is, every year I get the biggest booster shot when we go to our annual family retreat. And that's every June. And we have, this year we had almost 600 people there, and we had 160 families. And my favorite part every single year is the first day at registration when everybody's checking in. And it's a big reunion. So all the kids that have been there before are like grabbing hands and talking and just having the time of their lives. And then a child that's never been before, maybe has never met someone that looks like them, is so shy and will be kind of clinging to mom or dad, standing behind their leg, and they'll see a kid that looks like them, and instantly they just come out from behind mom or dad, and they just look so excited. And what I love is that the CCA kids will run over and grab their hand, and all of a sudden these little group of kids has run off, and, you know, mom or dad is there like, oh no, my child just ran away from me. But also they're so relieved, because there was no hesitation. There was no staring. There were no questions. I've seen little girls. One of my favorite moments was two little girls were standing there, and the little girl who'd never been there before, she touched her hearing aid. You know, you could tell she was thinking, oh, that little girl has hearing aids like mine. And then one of our kids who'd been there before ran over, grabbed her hand, and looked at her nail polish and said, oh, I love your nail polish. And you could see the little girl who'd never met someone before was just like, this is acceptance. This is a friend. And so those are my favorite moments, and I get dozens of those over the course of the weekend.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay.
More information about CCA Kids can be found at ccakids.org. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Put the University of Windsor experience in the palm of your hand with the UWindsor app. Sign in with your UWindsor ID to review individual courses, grades, and exam schedules. Update your personal financial accounts and connect with the latest news and social events. Anyone can download the app to find a campus map, directory, and more. Even listen to CJAM FM by pressing the CJAM button on the bottom left-hand corner. Stay in touch with the campus community with the UWindsor app. Available for Android and Apple devices.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that promotes recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Erica Mossholder, was telling us a little bit about facial differences, and author Phyllis Penn. In this next segment of our show, we'll hear from Katia Hill from the AAC Institute.
All right. Well, my name is Katia Hill, and I'm a speech-language pathologist and an associate professor at the University of Pittsburgh. But I founded a nonprofit organization called AAC Institute almost 20 years ago, and also a clinic associated with the Institute, I Can Talk Clinic. The mission of the Institute is dedicated to the most effective communication for people who rely on augmentative and alternative communication. And what I know from my clinical work as a speech-language pathologist working in the field of AAC is that the two most important values expressed by people who rely on AAC are they want to be able to say exactly what they want to say and not what someone else thinks they want to say, and then to be able to say it as fast as they can using technology.
So when you talk about augmentative communication, most of us think about just the keyboard and the speaker, but are there other forms that you can describe for the audience?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because a lot of people have a misperception that AAC may be limited to either manual or no technology options or computer-based and mobile technology. But there are a full range of options from no technology to high-performance, dedicated speech-generating devices. And the most critical feature that allows people to meet their goal are the language programs that are available on systems. So if there's not a robust language program that has very effective rate enhancement strategies or organization of vocabulary, their potential to achieve is going to be negatively impacted.
So what are some of the challenges in finding the right device and the right methods for a client, just getting them matched up correctly?
Well, first of all, I was invited to a consensus committee at the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine 2 years ago, and we published a report called The Promise of Assistive Technology to Enhance Activity and Work Participation. And an overwhelming finding or consensus of that committee was that accessibility and availability of access to equipment, but also skilled clinical services, really needs to be improved. So right now, a person could be matched appropriately to technology, but more likely than not, we have untrained or undertrained practitioners that may be making decisions. And they're making decisions to get equipment matched to somebody without necessarily taking their time for a comprehensive evaluation or fully informing individuals of all of their options. So if we're going to a doctor and a doctor provides us with a diagnosis and then says this is treatment for that disorder, we expect that physician to be giving us the full range of all possible medical options and also be relying on his recommendations to us based on evidence. And that is clearly not what happens today in the field of AAC for a vast majority of individuals that cannot talk or need technology.
So to look at the converse side of things, in your time as speech-language pathologist and all the time that you've devoted, is there any success story that stands out for you?
Oh, there are overwhelming success stories that I've had with clients, and many of the individuals that I've provided clinical services to have become close friends. So I think one of my favorite stories is with a woman who I consider my friend now with cerebral palsy who uses AAC, and her name is Jen Lowe. And I was invited to participate in a conference in Thailand And Jen accompanied me to that trip. So you can imagine the flight experience, how long that was. No complaints whatsoever. But the princess, one of the princesses of Thailand, helps to sponsor that particular conference called iCreate. And because Jen was such an effective user of her AAC system, we had a personal audience with the Princess of Thailand. So I like to say, although I invited Jen to come to Thailand with me, I was able to meet the Princess of Thailand because of Jen's skills using AAC. And what was also very important about that visit is through that conference, Jen changed people's impressions about how effective somebody could be using AAC voice output technology. And they completely did a reversal of the type of technology they wanted to develop in Thailand for individuals that needed AAC, and realizing it's a language issue more than it is a technology issue. So they were then working on a robust program for the Thai language that would allow people to say what they wanted to say and then say it as fast as they could.
So if you could send any message to the community about why AAC matters and why it's somebody's right to communicate, what would you say?
Well, the essence of being a human being is that we have language to be able to express our thoughts, our feelings, be creative, interact with other individuals in our lives. It's that sharing, caring expression of who we are. And the most effective communication allows someone to be able to reach their potential, whatever that potential might be. And that's the message, is to ensure that the services that you're receiving are allowing someone to reach their potential, to express themselves in their unique qualities as a human being. So never stop from trying to reach that goal, to find individuals with the knowledge and skills that can help achieve that goal. And they might be far and few between, but there are dedicated individuals that are able to help people. So at I Can Talk Clinic, we have people coming from around the world to be evaluated, to help set up a treatment program. We run summer camps for children that are using AAC, so parents can go back home with examples of what strategies worked to motivate their child to use their AAC system. So an example of this is at our most recent camp last week for young adults, we found that almost 100% of our campers had not been properly fitted with their AAC system, like mounted on their wheelchairs properly. So if they were using eye gaze, they hadn't necessarily been properly calibrated with the eye gaze system. Or if they were calibrated and it was mounted on their device, the distance of their technology from their eyes was at an inappropriate distance, not allowing the device to work properly. And so the first morning of our camp was making just those kinds of adjustments, that parents were wondering why their child wasn't motivated to use the device. Well, it wasn't even set up properly for them. So they had high-performance systems, but yet that final tweaking of what would make it efficient for them had not been done.
So you were mentioning about some of the policies where you are and how disability rights are being somewhat curtailed. Can you give me an overview of that?
Yes, I'd be happy to, because the AAC Institute does do advocacy work in trying to improve reimbursement and billing policies for AAC services. But what has become a major or big concern for us now is this gradual hacking away of special education policies, disability policies such as ADA. I never felt that with all of our advocacy work in the 70s, 80s, and into 90s that we'd ever be concerned about ADA and losing any of the rights that that helped to establish for individuals with disabilities. And now I'm, you know, making trips to Washington, D.C. to be discussing concerns about policies being removed that have been protecting individuals with disabilities and helping to improve quality of life.
So how do you think we as a society can change the minds and the hearts of those in power, get them to see that these rights, they're really needed?
Well, we have to stay in an advocacy mode. It's all of us that have to be protecting all of our rights. You know, having a disability is just a moment away for any of us. As we're aging, we may develop disabilities. But one of our campers this year was in a car accident and left with a traumatic brain injury and is now in a wheelchair and using AAC. That car accident was a moment away for his family. They were returning from a ski trip. So all of us need to be concerned about these safeguards for the most vulnerable individuals in our society, because that could be us or a family member. And it's our compassion. It shows just our compassion as a society, as if we are concerned and we can sit down with legislators or congressmen and their willingness to talk to us. And there are many doors now in Washington, D.C. that I cannot get meetings for, even those that are my state senator or my state congressman to open and sit down and talk. And in the past, it was easier to get into offices that were even not my senator or my congressman.
Thank you.
So we all need to be active and concerned.
Thank you very much for taking the time out. So, to reiterate a point from earlier in the show, so I was out traveling recently. I had the privilege of sharing a little bit about my thoughts on disability life with a few new friends I met on the train. I met one named Teresa, who said she might have a story of addictions to share here on the show. Said she'd be listening, and I hope she's out there and hears this episode, because anyone with the story to share in disability life is always welcome. If you're such a person, write HandyLink 4, HandyLink, the numeral 4, gmail.com. This is the wonderful thing, though. When you're traveling and you're out there, you meet a group of people, get to talking, and if you're someone with a disability, you might even walk away having made the world shine a little brighter because you shared a little bit about yourself, your perspectives on equality. That's the thing, though. A lot of people assume a person with a disability doesn't want to talk about it. This trip, for me, really proved that wrong, and I'm grateful to have had the chance to share insights. Because we all have a voice that needs to be heard, a voice that counts. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.